like the first 9 verses to get us going?
Yeah, I'll do that. Ezekiel 7, 1 through 9. Moreover, the word of the Lord came to me, saying, And you, son of man, thus says the Lord God to the land of Israel, An end. The end has come upon the four corners of the land. Now the end has come upon you, and I will send my anger against you. I will judge you according to your ways, and I will repay you for all your abominations. My eye will not spare you, nor will I have pity, but I will repay your ways, and your abominations will be in your midst. Then you shall know that I am the Lord. Thus says the Lord God. A disaster, a singular disaster, behold, it has come. An end has come. The end has come. It has dawned for you. Behold, it has come. Doom has come to you, you who dwell in the land. The time has come. A day of trouble is near, and not of rejoicing in the mountains. Now, you said through nine.
Mm-hmm.
Gotcha. And now upon you, I will soon pour out my fury and spend my anger upon you. I will judge you according to your ways, and I will repay you for all your abominations. My eye will not spare you, nor will I have pity. I will repay you according to your ways, and your abominations will be in your midst. Then you shall know that I am the Lord who strikes.
Pretty heavy.
You hear it the first time, you're going to hear it the second time.
Yeah. That sounds similar to what we read in the last chapter.
Mm-hmm.
We've only got about 24 more chapters to go through.
Exactly the same.
Yeah.
You know, in verse 5, life is unique disaster, it's not single disaster.
Mm-hmm.
So what's the original say?
Verse 5.
Unique, mm-hmm. Did you say?
Yeah,
singular. That's kind of
right. That's
similar.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's the same, isn't it?
Mm-hmm.
Disaster, a singular
one
disaster.
One disaster is a disaster, so it is referring just to one, but
mm-hmm.
You guys don't say anything about it being different in a sense.
Yeah, I haven't looked at the original on that one, but my guess is it's a word that basically can be used either direction, right? It can mean unique or an isolated. The idea that it being isolated being that there's not another like it.
Yeah, single, unique disaster.
Mm-hmm.
Mine and that.
It
says, this is what the Lord says, look, one disaster after another is coming. So.
Mm-hmm.
No, it's a series, one, then another, then another.
Mm-hmm. So notice he says, according to your ways, I'm going to repay your ways, according to your ways. And then he mentions some.
Yeah, but it's among you.
Hmm?
I thought it was interesting. Put it among
me in your midst.
Yeah. It's not like, I don't know, it seemed interesting. And he said it twice.
Where is that now?
Within, you know.
Your abomination.
Among
yeah.
You.
So, why
it's
would he?
It's not going to be removed or, you know, out there somewhere or passing through. It's going to be sitting right there.
Right. So, why might he emphasize the abominations? What are the abominations, and why would he emphasize they're in your midst? Your abominations will be in your midst. Why might he?
Well, whatever, it's a cause and effect, and that's the effect, and they were the ones that brought it on themselves.
Okay, so he's one possibility.
He's making them responsible.
He's just telling them that when these things happen, you'll be reminded of why.
Mm-hmm.
Because these things are in your midst. What were some of the abominations, though? What sort of things were abominable to God?
Well, they were worshiping false idols.
Okay, they're worshiping false idols.
One of the main ones.
Yeah. So one of the titles of God that he makes a big deal about is he is the living God, right?
Mm-hmm.
And when there's a lot of passages that talk about idols. How does he contrast himself to the idols?
They're dead.
They're dead. Mm-hmm. They have to be carried.
Yeah.
Propped up.
Lifeless.
They're lifeless.
Can't see or hear.
Right. Mm-hmm. And so part of this idea between dead and living is that they can't respond. In other words, they're false, mm-hmm. right?
Mm-hmm.
So when you cry out to the living God, at least he's living, right?
Right.
And so he can initiate a response. So when you cry out to these false idols, you know, there's lots of passages where he says, you know, I'm not going to listen to you, you know, turn and ask for your false
mm-hmm.
idols to bail you out, right?
Mm-hmm.
See if they'll come and help you, right? And it's like this sarcasm.
Yeah.
Where he's saying, you know, you trusted in these idols when things were going well, and, you know, it's just like Elijah on Mount Carmel, right, with the prophets of Baal, because he says, you know, call down fire to take this, to burn this offering, and, he, you know, they do all these sorts of things, and he says, well, maybe he's gone off to the restroom and stuff like this,
mm-hmm.
right, and he's saying, you know, What?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, he's taunting him, saying, "What's wrong with your God? If he's so mighty, mm-hmm. he's deaf. You know,
mm-hmm.
he doesn't seem to be coming." So that's the same, some of the same idea. And so one other aspect here is that, you know, you're going to go through these things even with your idols just right there. So you can't.
And they won't be able to save you.
They won't be able to save you.
Yeah.
They're right there in your midst. And they're not doing anything for you, right? Kind of thing.
The other thing I like is God. Anytime He brings punishment or, you know, chastisement, wrath, He tells you why. Because
yeah.
if you get it without knowing why, because I always ask people, say, "Well, why did God do that?" And I go, "What makes you think God did?" You know what I mean? Because I said, if he did it, you're going to know why he got it.
Mm-hmm.
I said, it doesn't make, God's not going to
yeah.
chastise you without telling you why.
Mm-hmm.
You'll know for a fact why you're getting it.
Yeah.
And that's what I see about that. He's telling them why. So it's your fault, and this is why I'm doing it. And it mostly, too, it's, because he loves them, and he's telling them why.
Yeah, because
they will change and
right,
quit.
Because right. out the other side of all these, there's a chance for restoration, and if you can learn from what you've gone through, hopefully, we're slow learners. But that is the goal. I mean,
mm-hmm.
he's not just punitive, I don't see.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I don't
right.
think he enjoys any of this.
Mm-mm.
He enjoys righteousness, and seeing that come about, but
mm-hmm.
there's a difference between that and enjoying
right.
just bringing this.
He's angry, yes,
yeah.
but it's a righteous anger.
Yeah.
Right. Because he's going to judge you according to your ways.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not
going to
be
good at that.
Mm-hmm.
This thing with the singular disaster that we're talking about.
Mm-hmm.
It seems to me like it's a special event. It's something that's out of the ordinary. A singular
mm-hmm.
disaster. It's like a singular event. Something that you'll know, like you said.
Mm-hmm.
It emphasizes that this is a special event, and you're going to know it because it's
yeah.
different,
mm-hmm.
unique.
Right. I think when we get to the latter part of the chapter, he gives more clues about what's unique about it. But if you think about what's coming for them, what would be unique about the historical situation? What are some of the things that are unique about it?
Oh, yeah.
How is this all going to come about?
Well, I was kind of thinking, when you said the singular disaster, I thought about like bold judgments. You have a bold judgment, that'd be the singular, and then underneath that there's one, two, three, four, you know, there's one right up, but they're all bold judgments.
Mm-hmm.
Same, kind of same thing here. You've got this, and but there's one right after another, but this is why. But it's one singular event, but there's several of them coming just against that one singular event.
Mm-hmm.
Oh. Well, and they're going to get carried away. They're going to get captured.
Okay, yeah, so they're going to get captured, but what's maybe worse than that?
Well, the temple is going to be destroyed.
Yeah, so the temple especially,
yeah, temple,
right?
Yeah.
So part of this idea, just like Israel would say, well, we have Abraham for our father, you know, so nothing bad can happen to us kind of thing. There is this idea, too, that we have God in our midst, right?
Mm-hmm.
And so, and the place in which he dwells is the temple. So, you know, enemies could do lots of different things, but surely, you know, they're not going to, you know, take over the temple or overthrow the temple. And I think when you look a little bit later in this chapter, you see him mention, he says, he talks about verse 21, I will give it as plunder into the hands of strangers, and to the wicked of the earth as spoil. They shall defile it. I will turn my face from them, and they will defile my secret place. Say verse 22.
Mm-hmm.
And then he talks about where does he say, I will bring the worst of the Gentiles, verse 24. And I'm not finding the right phrase in here, let's see, but he talks about, I guess it maybe, let's see, is it in the, oh, it's in here, let's see, I'm just trying to find it. Yeah, verse 22, they will defile my secret place, robbers shall enter it and defile it. So
that's when they took all of the things from all the utensils from inside the temple,
mm-hmm.
and took them to Babylon, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah.
So normally the Holy of Holies, right,
mm-hmm.
only the high priest could go in once a year, and only after he's had all these preparations, right?
Mm-hmm.
So even for the common, even for the average Levite to go in there would be death,
mm-hmm.
if he's not the high priest, right? He's got to be in the line of Aaron and all
right.
that. And so then for the average Jew to walk in there, that's trouble too.
Mm-hmm.
And God is saying,
mm-hmm.
you think that's bad?
Mm-hmm.
I'm going to let the dogs come in.
Yeah, not only that, I think God's going to leave before all this, and that's how
right.
they can go in there.
That's right.
And he's
mm-hmm.
going to get up, go up, that she talks about it, leaving above the cherubim and going out.
Right.
I think that's somewhere.
Yeah, that's coming up in chapter 10, 11, right? So part of it is that ground zero of where he's placed his name, and essentially where it's been since Solomon's time, right?
Mm-hmm.
So this is, you know, right in this section here, we're around 590 BC. Solomon's temple is around 1,000,
mm-hmm.
roughly time period. So it's, you know,
wow.
it's been 400 or 500 years that temple's been there. And, you know, there were all the sacrifices that Solomon made, and then the glory of the Lord filled the temple, and they took the tabernacle into the temple. So there was this whole, you know, it's his house where he said he would put his name, and he made a lot of promises that if they behaved, he would be in their midst forever. And so you know, like we tend to hear promises of God, we don't necessarily listen to the conditions so well as the promise, right? And fortunately, a lot of the promises are unconditional. But in the case where he's talking about their possession of the land, staying in the land, and having him in their midst, it was contingent upon their response. So, but there was still this view that, you know, they at one time they had had the ark fall into the hands of the Philistines. Remember, it was a similar situation where there was sin in the land, and God allowed the ark to be captured by the Philistines. And so, when the ark came back, and then eventually David and Solomon built a place for it and installed it in the temple, there was this feeling that, okay, God's back in our midst, and you know, there might be this or might be that, we might be judged, but it's unthinkable for the nuclear power plant of the universe, you know, the temple, if you want to think about it that way. When God's there, it's the nuclear power plant of the universe. You know, nothing could happen to it, right? I mean, a black hole could come near it and it wouldn't suck it up because God's there. You know, it's that kind of thing. But here's a situation where, like Jerry says, God's going to bail, and then the unthinkable is going to happen. He's going to allow these dirty Gentiles to come in there and paw over this stuff, haul it off. And I think the ultimate, when he talks about it, that they're going to be defiled, not only is the place defiled because Gentiles come in there, but these actual temple treasures that get hauled off to Babylon. You remember in Babylon chapter 5.
Babylon chapter 5. That's a new book.
Daniel chapter 5.
So Nebuchadnezzar
hauled this stuff off, and God gave it into Nebuchadnezzar's hand, but he treated it with respect. Mm-hmm. He didn't use it for common things. He put it away and kept it, but he didn't defile it by using it for common stuff. So then you have this drunken party in chapter 5 with Belshazzar, with the finger handwriting on the wall. And if you look at how that all takes place, the trigger really for that hand is when they take these vessels from the temple, and they're drinking from them at this party. And the implication is, and his story tells us as well as other passages, that they're drunk. Mm-hmm. It's not just a party, they're drunk. And you know, he's drinking from it, and his lords and his concubines, they're all having this, you know, worldly party and drunk and reveling in using these sacred vessels from the temple, which even Nebuchadnezzar wouldn't have done, you know. So there's this whole issue that not only is he going to allow Gentiles in and take this stuff, which defiles the holy place, but the treasures themselves are going to be used for debauchery later on.
What the time frame is between God leaving the temple and the temple, you know, basically being destroyed?
Yeah, roughly.
I mean, is it just
No, it's about a 3-year period. So 3 to 4 years, depending on who you read. It'd be like 590 to 587, 586, somewhere in there. So it's a lot like, it's a little shorter, but it's similar to the business where the veil is rent in twain, right? At the crucifixion of Jesus, and when Jesus went thither.
Yeah.
That is another
term. I'm tweening.
She's looking at me like, you're using King James. And so I read a passage in Josephus on Sunday where it talked about going thither.
Thither.
And I'm like,
but I'm thinking twang, like, oh, the curtains just went twang.
You're giving me
word pictures over here.
But anyway, so there was a period of time between, I think most people would say that when the veil was torn, that was, and from top to bottom, that's God's pronouncement saying the sacrifices, you know, I've made a way for people to approach me that doesn't require this veil.
Mm-hmm.
And so all the sacrifices of place after that, there's a different aspect to them. You know, Paul still went in there and offered sacrifices and stuff, so I don't want to say that they're completely off base and ineffectual, but those who still wanted to approach God through these sacrifices were essentially denying, you know, this work that God had done in rending the veil, as far as if they, depending on how they viewed it. Because obviously some of the believing Jews who were members of the early church, like Paul, still were involved in the temple worship, and they didn't see it as being heretical, you know, or blasphemous. But at that point, I mean, Jesus crucified, obviously, his prediction that the temple would be destroyed, he'd already given that. And then there was like, you know, like a 40-year period there before Titus and Vespasian and Titus wipe out the temple. So there can be delays between when God essentially... I would say there that if you look at typology, I think you can make the argument that when Jesus leaves the temple on the last time and he says, "Behold, your house is left to you desolate," mm-hmm. at the end of Matthew 23, he's essentially saying there, "I'm the glory of God. I've left to the east," just like in Ezekiel, "and I'm going to go up to the Mount of Olives." But he's basically saying there that your house is left desolate, that it's now unprotected from here on out. It's just a matter of time now before it mm-hmm. will fall.
I have one question, something you said, and I never realized it. Why would you think Paul would go back and do Jewish, basically go back under the law and do the temple mm-hmm. thing and still be a believer?
Uh-huh.
It's almost like you're taking and turning your back, in a sense, and going backward. I'm not saying he's wrong. I just yeah. want to understand why he would do it.
Right. Well, I think if you look at Peter and Paul both, they were still involved with temple situations. And part of it, I think, has to do with this idea that when people read Hebrews, there's an assumption there that I think a connection that people make, that they believe that, well, the animal sacrifices, how do I want to put it, the animal sacrifices are blasphemous during that period because they're trying to do what the blood of Christ does.
Mm-hmm.
But I think if you look at what Ezekiel teaches in the latter part about the millennial temple, and you look at more carefully at what it says in the book of Hebrews, I think what it's showing is that the animal sacrifices were for a different purpose than Jesus' sacrifice on the cross. There are similarities, but they're different. And so people like Paul understood that the veil was rent, but mm-hmm. also if you look at what the apostles, the advice they gave him, they basically said that people were believing that he was teaching against the laws of Moses, and therefore mm-hmm. go and, you know, sponsor these guys.
Mm-hmm.
And so part of the issue there is that there's a subtlety between Paul was not saying that it was wrong for people who wanted to keep the laws of Moses. He wasn't saying that. He was saying that it was wrong to say that you had to keep the laws of Moses as part of being saved. So there's this whole business where people are free to honor things from the laws of Moses if they want to, but they're not to be looking at them as the means of salvation or of a means of being righteous before God. So there's this, that's why you see in Acts, you see this whole issue where they're still around the temple, they're mm-hmm. still ministering in the temple, and they're still even involved in some of the temple rites.
Mm-hmm.
But it's not like the day that the veil is rent, he runs away and says, you know, the temple is a blasphemous place. And you also, you know, the other aspect on the other end of it is in Revelation 11, when it talks about the tribulation temple, God has an angel that shows John that measures the temple, and it talks about that parts of it have been given to the Gentiles to tread down. But if you read that passage, you get a very distinct idea that God is paying attention to what's going on there. The fact that the angel measures it, usually when you see an angel measuring something, it's an indication that God is paying attention to it, that it has significance from God's point of view, that it's not a blasphemous idol.
Yeah, he's establishing.
There's something going on there that God cares about, and even if it's still not quite what's supposed to eventually happen, it's significant to what God is doing. And then the fact that he says the Gentiles trample the outer courts or whatever, it says there, I'd have to read it again exactly, but that's a back of the hand. It's saying these unclean Gentiles have access to parts of it. So God is in that section of 11 there, he's saying that temple is significant to him, and even though I think you can make the case that the people that are offering sacrifices there are not believing Christians, mm-hmm. that it's a motion that's moving in the direction of the restoration of Israel, mm-hmm. you know, and it plays a part in the end time scene that God has. But it's kind of surprising, because when you read through it, you don't see an obvious condemnation of what's going on there, where you might expect that, right? Mm-hmm. So I think there is this tendency to view that the temple there as immediately being something that believing Jews hated and thought was blasphemous. But if you actually look at what takes place in the book of Acts and the whole transition period, you don't really see that play out.
When he says that part of the court's going to be left, the outer court's going to be left for the Gentiles. Now that it has to do, doesn't it, with the temple that's being built before the Millennial Kingdom?
Yeah, I think
not
so.
Not during the Millennial Kingdom.
Right.
So, because that's a totally different thing. That's totally in Jewish, I mean, it even shows the land and everything.
Yeah.
That's allotted to the temple. So that's where they get the idea where it could be a joint thing with the Dome of the Rock still in that area,
mm-hmm.
and the new Hebrew temple being built and having them both at the same time.
Right.
That's just surmising, I guess.
I think if you take little hints from different passages and put them together, you like in Daniel 9:27 where it talks about, I believe it's a reference to Antichrist saying he will make a covenant with many in Israel, and then it says for 1 week, and in the middle of the week he'll bring an end to sacrifice and offering. The implication, again, it's an implication reading between the lines, is that agreement has to do with the other side of things, which is allowing the offering and sacrifice to take place, because, you know, it mentions this agreement, then it says partway through he essentially violates it looks like. And so the agreement seems to be having to do with offering and sacrifice. And there in Revelation 11, you've got this temple where there's a Gentile involvement. And the implication is, well, if they have a temple, you know what they're going to do. Because what one of the things we would see if we looked at the broader picture of this whole thing is when you look at Haggai and some of the other books related to the other end when they come back out of Babylonian captivity, one of the key things they do is they lay the foundation for the new temple after they come out from Babylon, what you would call Zerubbabel's temple, or it becomes Herod's temple. But that temple, they start offering sacrifice there before it's built. So this whole business of recognizing God and sacrificing is key to having a temple. So I think when you look at all those pictures, you get a little bit more complicated idea of the overlap between the transitions that take place. Because clearly, you know, the scriptures clearly teach that we are the temple, mm-hmm. living temple, and Jesus made comments about, you know, that his body would be a temple and so forth. So there's this whole issue where we know today with no temple that we are the temple. But at the same time, there was a period there where the church was in existence, the people who were the temple of the living God, and there was still a physical temple, although definitely the glory of God, you know, wasn't there. And in fact, you know, and this is one of those things where if you read, you know, the Bible gives you what we need to have, but there's some history that talks about these issues too. And one of the things you'll read is that the glory that departs in Ezekiel's temple here, or in this Solomon's temple here, is never said to be in the next temple, in Zerubbabel's temple, or the Herod's temple. And that's where, when that temple is being rebuilt, God makes some statement, you know, when the people are wailing about it being small and not looking, the people who'd seen the previous temple, he makes the point that it will be more glorious. And I think there's different ways to view that, but one way to view that is that Jesus is going to come to that temple. So there's a sense in which, in the plan of God and the focus on Jesus' work and ministry, there's a sense in which Jesus showing up in the incarnation into that temple is every bit as significant as the Shekinah showing up at Solomon's temple.
Well, it reminds you of John the Baptist. You know, I must diminish so he increases, and it's like that temple was, you know, more plain, whatever it is, before he showed up. So there's a greater contrast between them.
So when you look at Acts 15, where there's this issue of what do the Gentiles have to do to be saved? Do they need to keep parts of the law of Moses, for example, circumcision? They come out with a statement, you know, basically saying these are the things that we're most concerned about that we'd like the Gentiles to think about, and part of it has to do with being in fellowship with Jews who are practicing the law. So when they say things like don't eat blood, right? Part of that statement is recognizing there's a bunch of Jewish believers that are still looking at the law of Moses, and they would be offended by somebody eating blood, right? So the flip side of them saying what Gentiles, here's what we care about, the flip side of that is recognizing, hey, there are Jewish believers who are still practicing the laws of Moses. They're not looking for it for salvation. It's not a requirement for salvation. They're not saying, Gentiles, you have to do this, but they're still observing, you know. And he says, you know, if somebody wants to observe a feast, they can observe a feast.
Yeah, I always wondered why that was, those stipulations were put on the Gentiles, actually. Because in one place he says they're free from all that,
right?
But then that they put that stipulation on them, so that was curious.
Yeah, I think the key is fellowship, you know, together.
Yeah.
Well, in a sense, they'd be a weaker brother.
Exactly.
So
yeah.
Keep them from doing
right.
Our freedom. Well, we can do that.
Right.
That way. Yeah.
And like eating meat offered at the temple type thing.
Yeah. It'd be like if somebody who was raised in high church, right? You know, like real formal church, like in England and other places in Europe, where you got these huge cathedrals with, you know, real ornate and all this stuff. And they came here on Sunday.
Yeah.
Like, this is like the opposite extreme.
They would just
of high church.
The world going on.
There's a sense in which, if you really loved them and you wanted to fellowship with them, you would extend patience and try to accommodate maybe some of their ideas about what was significant. You know, if it really bugged them that there wasn't a candle anywhere in the church, would it really hurt us to have a candle, right? So, you know, you got to be careful,
yeah.
You know,
yeah.
But it's the same sort of issue, right?
Yeah, makes sense.
So in Acts 15, where that occurs, you have part of the discussion there is there's some, how's he call it? Let me go there, because I can't remember exactly how it's put, and I don't want to really say it the wrong way. I said it's a big deal.
Where are you going?
Acts 15. Yeah. So in Acts 15, it starts out with the first verse. Certain men came down from Judea and taught the brethren, unless you are circumcised according to the custom of Moses, you cannot be saved.
That's changing something.
So the key phrase there is you cannot be saved.
Mm-hmm.
And Paul and Barnabas had no small dissension and dispute with them, right? So then Paul and Barnabas go up to Jerusalem to see about this question. And in verse 5, in Jerusalem, some of the sect of the Pharisees who believed. So these are...
That's key.
Yeah, who believed. They rose up saying, it's necessary to circumcise them and to command them to keep the law of Moses. So these are Christian Jews that, you know, they're believers.
Mm-hmm.
And so then there's this big discussion. And notice the one who kind of speaks up here is Peter in verse 7. He says, men and brethren, you know that a good while ago God chose among us that by my mouth the Gentiles should hear the word of the gospel and believe. So God, who knows the heart, acknowledged them by giving them the Holy Spirit just as he did to us, and made no distinction between us and them, purifying their hearts by faith. So then he goes on to say, why do you test God by putting a yoke on them that we couldn't even keep, right?
Mm-hmm.
And then in verse 11, we believe that through the grace of the Lord Jesus Christ, we shall be saved in the same manner as they.
Yeah.
So notice he's saying,
yeah,
you know, the way that we're saved, you know, you guys keep thinking about this law and the law of Moses, but that's not how we're saved. We couldn't keep it. It was a yoke on our neck, and now you want to put that same yoke on the Gentiles. And he's in a sense, it's real irony what he says in verse 11, because the whole focus is, we're the Jews, we're saved. How can the Gentiles be saved? Are they really saved? You know,
yeah,
all this question. And here he's saying, well,
yeah,
you know, we'll be saved in the same manner as they. He's kind of turning it on its head.
Mm-hmm.
So there that whole issue comes up, but he doesn't say, the sect of the Pharisees, he doesn't say, you need to completely drop anything you're practicing from the law of Moses. He doesn't say that.
At first was me. He was, the first portion of Paul's ministry, he was going to the synagogues. And he was teaching to the Jews primarily.
Right.
And until every time he'd get in there, and then they'd keep raising all this fuss about, you know, the way he was teaching.
Mm-hmm.
And then where was it where he said him and Barnabas, I think it was at Antioch, he said, mm-hmm, we're going to the Gentiles. He just leaves. He kind of gives up on the Jewish aspect of his ministry and goes to the Gentiles, and then it becomes mostly Gentiles with Jews, you know, too, who believe. So it's kind of a mixture, mm-hmm, transitional point.
Mm-hmm.
So the distinction here, though, is salvation without works. And that's the thing that they will not, you know, works are not involved.
Mm-hmm.
As soon as they try to put that in, then that's when the walls go up and defense starts and like this. But other than that, it's, as long as it doesn't change the salvation, then it's okay.
Yeah.
We can do it as long as you don't change the core.
I kind of came to the conclusion that God knows your heart, whether you're a Jew who's doing all these other things or whether you're not a Jew, however you are, God knows your heart and whether you're saved or not. And that determines your future. So I would think that the Jews now, the Messianic Jews, still labor through this keeping festivals and feasts and stuff like that, and traditions that they've been raised with their whole lives, you know. And it's kind of be difficult to just totally abandon your whole way of life and cut it off like that and become a freed up again Christian, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So. And I kind of think that's what's happening here, is this transition between being Jewish believers and Gentile believers. It goes primarily Jewish with a few Gentiles to primarily Gentiles with a few Jewish believers.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So if we look in Acts 21, we'll see them giving Paul, telling Paul what they want him to do. So Paul and some of the disciples from Caesarea, they went up to Jerusalem. And then on verse 18 of Acts 21, on the following day, Paul went in with us to James and all the elders, and he told then in verse 19 the detail of those things which God had done among the Gentiles through his ministry. And then they heard it, they glorified the Lord, and they said to him, "You see, brother, how many myriads of Jews there are who have believed, and they are zealous for the law. But they have been informed about you that you teach all the Jews who are among the Gentiles to forsake Moses." That's the key phrase. "Saying that they ought not to circumcise their children, nor to walk according to the customs. What then? The assembly must certainly meet, for they will hear that you have come. Therefore do what we tell you. We have four men who have taken a vow. Take them and be purified to them. Pay their expenses, etc., etc." But look at the end of verse 24. "That all may know that those things of which they were informed concerning you are nothing, but that you yourself also walk orderly and keep the law. But concerning the Gentiles who believe, we have written and decided that they should observe no such thing, except," and then it repeats the things from Acts 15.
So Paul did that stuff just to appease these people, knowing that it really didn't, it was circumstance whether he did it or not. He didn't do it as a ritual that he thought he had to keep. He did it just to appease the Jews who wanted to keep the law.
Right, and so part of what he's saying there, though, is it's okay if you want to practice the law.
Which seems weird, you know, that right, that he would say that
right
to me.
Is this part of kind of like, "I'll be all things to all men, that I may save some"?
I think it's the same idea, yeah. That, Paul, you know, Paul is... Part of the thing for Paul is he has a situation where, like he says, if he's persecuted because of the offense of the cross. So Paul is constantly beating the table saying, salvation is by faith through the shed blood of Christ. Works can't get you there. The law could not achieve that. And then he goes on to say, you know, If I'm not teaching against the law as a means, why am I being persecuted, right? Mm-hmm. So there's this issue where he's got the worst of both worlds. On the one hand, he's trying to protect the Gentiles from being dragged back into this idea that, you know, you need to keep the law. And on the other hand, he's also being attacked for saying, some Jews are saying that he's trying to abolish the law. Which he's not saying that you can't keep a law, or you can't keep a festival or a feast or whatever. He just, and in the parts where he talks about those feasts and stuff, he says to some, the feast days are special, to some others, every day is alike. Let each be fully convinced. So he's allowing the freedom to still do these things. Our problem is when we come to the scriptures, we're so rightly concerned about law versus grace, to differentiate that you don't earn salvation by works, that when we smell even the slightest thing that looks like works, we get really alarmed, rightly so. But I think here we need to differentiate them practicing aspects of the law from trusting in it for salvation.
This is kind of leading up to where Peter got himself into trouble. Mm-hmm. Where he was acting like one thing, and then all of a sudden when somebody else showed up, he acted like something else. So he gave a false witness, and he started acting like, I'm going to act like a Jew now. Well, if he was in that freedom, they shouldn't have said anything, because he was just being where he was at.
Yeah, so. You have to be a real strong character to do that when your buddies come up from Jerusalem, and all of a sudden you you're doing, living like a Gentile, and all of a sudden they're coming up and wondering, well, what's with you? I mean, you know, you're one of us, or whatever type of thing, you know?
Yeah.
Yeah, so I think you have this whole issue where, you know, you start to get a better appreciation over time for the difficult path that Paul had to walk. You know, he was correcting people like Peter and Barnabas about, you know, their duplicity. He was holding the line in Galatians and saying, look, if the law could get you there, Christ died for nothing, you know. So he's, in a sense, he's like the most champion Gentile teacher you can think of. And at the same time, he's the Pharisee of the Pharisees, and they're wanting him to go into the temple and do this temple right, because people have this impression that you're rejecting Moses, but you're not. You're just saying that there's a continuity there between Moses said that Jesus would come, right? So it's not like Moses is wrong.
You know, the Lutheran church on the island,
the little one.
Yeah, the little one there. Had an offer that they wanted us to come and sing a little bit there, right? And so I went on the website and looked at it, and, you know, it's like, boy, there's a lot of it looks like the Catholic Church. You know, it's not, but, you know, I know a lady that attends there that's got a picture of the Pope in her living room and sees no problem with that. And it's like, so the people that were in the law, you know, and it's got to be tough to not get sucked back there, you know. Even even that Lutheran church, man, that's getting, they keep the sacraments. That's what it says in their website. It's like, ooh, that's just a fine line. You're flipping back to the roots. Because that's the roots of it, and Luther fought so hard against that. But anyway, it's just an interesting dilemma, even for, you know, right in here, what we're talking about.
Yeah.
It takes strong, you know,
you have
a strong discernment on what can tip you right back to where you were. You
works,
know?
Works is there any way you look at it, and that's why I, you know, you walk the walk. I have to walk away from the Catholic Church, and
Well, my point's even a Lutheran church, Protestant church.
There are
different. I'd have to walk away from my
church. Terry, my wife Terry was a Lutheran, and before we moved up here, and there are different, they call them synods, or something like that. Anyway, they're different believing, and some of them are really basically the same thing as a Catholic, and some of them are a lot more liberal, you know, very much so. So that's depends on which one you're in.
Anyway, tough.
Yeah.
Tough. Things there.
Yeah,
and we've talked about this before, you know, I think anyone that has lived around religion and rejected it for years and then comes to be a believer, they tend to be, if my feelings are accurate and yours are, I think they tend to be really want to preserve the simplicity of what the Bible teaches, you know. And so, like, when you read on websites and stuff about churches that are talking about ancient faith, ancient worship, and they want to talk about what the Celts did in their churches or what other different religious movements did in the past, and they want to resurrect this ancient worship, and a lot of it's kind of liturgical and symbolic and stuff.
Yeah, sacrament. It's just the term sacrament.
Yeah.
You kind of wonder, okay, and, you know, Lutheran's different than that, you know, that's transubstantiation. Lutherans are partial.
Right.
So they're slightly different, but they're still more than we are.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
so all this, all these yellow and red flags come up, because, you know, when they say ancient worship, you know, the truly ancient worship's the New Testament. They want to go partway back to the New Testament and grab stuff that's like 8,300, 8,500,
80,000,
you know.
Yeah,
right?
Not far enough back.
And, you know, not all of that's bad, but a lot of it led in directions that corrupted the purity of biblical teaching. And so, you know, that they want to go there, part of the reason they want to go there, it's not that they're getting that from the Bible, because you can't find it in the Bible. You can't find contemplative prayer. You can't find labyrinths. You can't. There's just a bunch of things you can't find in the Bible. That's just not emphasized. In fact, worship itself, you know, styles of worship, it's just not really dealt with a great deal in the New Testament, whether musical or otherwise. So they want to put a lot of emphasis in that and downplay doctrine.
Mm-hmm.
But when you look at the New Testament, it puts all kinds of emphasis on doctrine, and it downplays the mode of worship. And so I say, okay, let's do ancient worship. Let's go back even more ancient than the guys you're going to, and let's keep going back till we get to Paul and Peter and the apostles.
Mm-hmm.
And so let's inform our church and our way of living and our practices from what the New Testament says. And what does it emphasize? Well, the Lord's Supper, and it emphasizes, you know, baptism.
You're not going to be referring to the sacraments, I would think, in the church.
Potentially,
that's
yeah.
What they used to, unless mm-hmm. they've added to it. I used to go to that church when I was in the island, but
mm-hmm.
it was, you know.
The lady you're talking.
I think it's changed. Go ahead.
The lady you're talking about, my guess is she's not into the Bible much.
Yeah,
and
that's
she
the
is,
feeling I get when I talk.
Yeah,
to her.
And my sister's the same way. You start talking to her, and then she's off into. You wouldn't believe what she's off. Does she know the truth? I think she does.
Yeah.
But she never gets below topsoil on it, so to speak. It's just right at the surface. Mm-hmm. I mean. Yeah, that's what I find with them.
Yeah, and see, Terry, back to my wife again, I think I mentioned this before. I believe she's been saved since, she, you know, she believes since she was like, she says 14 and a half, but she never knew, you know, the mm-hmm. in depth the whole thing, because
right.
it just wasn't ever taught to her.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So I think you're responsible for what you know as long as you.
Mm-hmm.
Believe Jesus died for your sins and rose from the grave, I guess.
Yeah, because they'll just talk, you know, first reading, that's one scripture.
Yeah.
Second reading, another scripture. And so it's like two verses of the Bible, and then they go off and do a topic.
Yeah.
Out of that.
She said they had the same kind of, in the church she went to in Oceanside, they had kind of like the same routine that they went through. The
right, on a given day.
Yeah.
Yeah, liturgy.
Well, yeah, the whole overhead, overseeing people would give you bulletins. They'd say from headquarters, every church in that synod has these two verses that day.
Mm.
And so they have a calendar, and they all do it simultaneously every Sunday on the different churches.
Yeah.
You know, so it's kind of from the top. Keep them all on the same page.
So that's really restrictive, because it just doesn't, you just don't. How can you get close to God if you don't know about Him, you know?
Mm-hmm.
That's the whole thing.
The Sunday.
Yeah, pretty much. I mean, sometimes they'll read the little chapter or something, but I never got it put together until I ventured here.
And Sunday school had delved into it more, I guess.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know, because I didn't go to church then, so it's, it was always talk to my wife. She's the one that goes to church.
Yeah. Well, I think even when we were engaged, right? I went. What was it called? What Lutherans believe?
Oh,
yeah. So they take you through a, you know,
what the church believes.
But it's not. It's more of a presentation of the church's views on things.
Yeah.
It's not really
salvation.
The Bible per se. And I think you know, for me, one of the things that was real eye-opener and refreshing when I got to the Bible and started reading it myself was, you know, where is all this hocus pocus?
Mm-hmm.
You know, where is all the pointy hats and, you know, all this
there.
Stuff? And so to me it was really refreshing because it wasn't there. Other people, you know, they really like that stuff. And so that's part of my, why am I, if the New Testament doesn't really talk so much about modes of worship, why am I critical of this ancient worship and some of the stuff the emergent church is doing? Well, the reason I'm critical of it is it's designed to appeal to non-believers and to appeal to people who like religion but don't understand the core message of Christianity. So you people who like pomp and circumstance ritual,
mm-hmm.
and all of us are susceptible to being led back into ritual very easily. So the inherent danger of it, and also in many cases it's used because it's a way of packaging Christianity to make it more user-friendly to people who really would be offended by the core message of Jesus. You can get them to hang around and have an emotional experience and so forth and so on, and love the rich liturgy, love the music, you know, but mm-hmm. you're not really
at the
gospel.
Yeah, I've known people who just, they say, I got to have something so I can gauge myself.
Mm-hmm.
And that really, and they said, I have to have that. And I go, okay, I mean, you've got it here. You can gauge yourself here. All you have to do is look. But they want something that you do this, you've attained that. You do this, you attain that. And they get an immediate response. Immediate. Doesn't matter. I just went through the motion. I changed my name, went up there, and I made my confirmation. Okay. Wow. Check that one off. And that's what we all did. We just checked it off and did that. And boy, got that out. Now, let's see, next one, I got to get married. You know, it's not what it comes down to.
Mm-hmm. My sister did that with my nieces, just, you know, get them, you know, baptized and get mm-hmm. them confirmed. And now I'm kind of done with my parenting in the church, you know.
I think man just has it in them. Mm-hmm. That they have to have something to do with it. You know, that's just in our
story.
That's the way we are. Mm-hmm. And so that's why mm-hmm. some of them go all the way, of course, and say that they're God and there is no God. But
mm-hmm.
they kind of.
Mm-hmm.
Andy Woods has got a good one on that. Salvation and believing.
Mm-hmm.
It is really good. I mean, three or four different parts to it.
Mm-hmm.
It's extremely good.
Mm-hmm.
And it's amazing what he comes up with. He sees things I never even thought of.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, he's very gifted.
Mm-hmm.
Teacher. Mm-hmm. That's why he's on the website.
What was his name?
Andy Woods.
Andy Woods. It's on his website.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Yeah, it's under, I forgot the word, soteriology.
Soteriology.
Yeah, soteriology.
Yeah, which is a Greek word for salvation. To get kind of back to where this all kind of started.
Sorry about that.
No, so we were talking about in Ezekiel 7 this whole issue of the defilement of the temple and the vessels, and just the significance of the temple as the place where God has chosen to put His name and manifest His dwelling presence. So, when we look at that passage, and he talks about, you know, the singular, if you will, or unique disaster.
You think that's the destruction of the temple, right?
My view is you don't mean to tell me that God would allow those guys into the Holy of Holy and also destroy the whole temple. I mean, it's one thing to get hauled off. It's another thing to ransack
mm-hmm.
God's temple.
Yeah.
Right?
Mm-hmm. God's there.
Yeah.
Can't do that.
And I think if you look at the history of that period, that is the most monumental event that you can think of from a perspective of the Scriptures. Because, you know, if you really back up and look at the whole picture of the Bible is about redemption, but really it's about God and man being together present. And redemption is how God restores that. So redemption is a smaller part of a bigger picture, which is God and man together.
Yeah.
And the separation then brought in the need for the redemption. And the redemption, of course, is glorious because that's how God orchestrates reunification with fallen man. But in that whole picture, when you start with the Garden of Eden and you end in Revelation 22, very clearly man and God's presence, an intimate presence, that's just a huge theme in the Bible. In fact, I'd say, next to God's glory, it's a pretty controlling theme. There's just a lot said about Jesus in the incarnation, about, God, we felt him and handled him and he was among us. And, so there's this whole issue of God and man together. And of course, so whenever you see a temple, in the scriptures, you got to kind of think of the temple as ground zero of God's attention. I mean, yeah, he's omniscient, he's omnipresent, but the temple itself has this huge significance in the big plan of God, the whole idea of a temple. And so, well, the landscape is littered with temples today, but none of them are the temple. We're the temple, but none of them are the temple. And even when there were, even before, Pentecost, when this temple was there, there were all these other temples, but none of them were the temple, this temple. So it's almost impossible to overemphasize the significance of the temple from a position of God's attention and his focus on being in the presence of man or having man approach him. So that's why when you see him talk to me, when he talks about this singular disaster, and then a little later in the same chapter he starts talking about his secret place. Mm-hmm. His secret place is a very special place to him. It's that's where I come from in thinking that's what it is. But it doesn't say explicitly. So shall we go on further?
Well, I think it's verse 2 that it talks about, this is coming on four corners of the land.
Mm-hmm.
And so when you're talking about the end and all this coming on in land Israel,
mm-hmm.
So then I'm kind of like, okay, so this disaster basically, I don't know, I'm having a hard time with it just being the temple, I guess.
Yeah.
Yeah, because it talks about, the people and isn't it like the temple and their dispersion out of land? I don't know.
Well, when he talks about,
what am I missing?
Well, okay, so
or did you
the people
it?
Going out of the land doesn't defiling.
Right.
Right.
Okay.
And he doesn't talk about thieves coming in and putting their Gentile-y hands on the people.
No.
It's he's talking about the things that are holy, right? So, and then I think if you sit back and look more at how this happened historically, you have around 606, you've got Daniel and a few other of the royalty descendants are hauled off. And then you got like 590 something or something, Ezekiel's hauled off, and a bunch more people. So it happens gradually that people are hauled away and Jerusalem is put under subject.
So it's like defined as a land.
Well, the land there.
And everything in it. Understand?
Yeah, so.
I guess.
So as this goes along in waves, okay?
Yeah.
It's gradual. It starts with just a few people and a little control. And then a lot more people and a lot more control. And then by the time you get down to the end, it's the city and the temple that's the focus, because God is ramping up his judgment in degrees. In fact, we haven't got there yet, but when we get to the next chapter, we're going to talk a little bit more about, there's these different predictions that God made about, that started with them, some of them being hauled off in Daniel's day, and then it ramps up when in Ezekiel's time a bunch more people are taken, and they're still unrepentant, so it's getting more and more serious. And the final part is the sacking and destruction of Jerusalem and the fall of the temple. So if you look at that level, if you look at those things developing, it's getting more serious, more serious, more serious, to the ultimate serious is when the temple is no more, the king, there is no, not even a vassal king anymore. So along with this, I mean, we're not talking about it so much, but there are other passages that are also saying, look, I'm going to turn against the scepter of my son, the Davidic scepter. He's going to come and judge the kings as well. So if you want to think about it as church and state, which is a reasonable way to think in the Old Testament, the kings and the priests were separate. They weren't the same. So there was this idea of a separation, if you will, of church and state, which is united in Jesus, who is priest and king. But when you look at that whole idea, there's this parallel stuff going on with the temple as there is going on with the city and the king. So, you know, when it's saying an end has come upon the four corners of the land, I think part of what it's saying there is that he's cutting off the whole southern kingdom. So historically, if you're looking at this, the northern kingdom, you have Solomon, after Solomon, you've got the civil war, the divided kingdom, and they're both going AWOL. The northern kingdom goes AWOL more quickly and gets dispatched by Assyria. The southern kingdom is still going, and you're hoping, well, okay, that's going to hold in there. But then eventually, God even judges, you know, even the throne of David, even the place where my name is.
And right. Probably, if you're talking singular event, then it has to be God leaving the temple.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, his presence leaving the temple, because all of that stuff that circles around God. And says, so God's just leaving. Then so what do you got left? You got nothing left in the whole deal, because it's all God-centric. It's all him.
Yeah. So I think when Jesus could use similar phrase when he leaves the temple in at the end of Matthew, you know, the singular disaster is that I'm leaving. Right. Any other comments before we go on to the next little section? I guess I'll go ahead and read since I haven't read for a little bit. Pick it up in verse, what, 10?
Mm-hmm. 10, yeah.
Behold the day, behold it has come. Doom has gone out, the rod has blossomed, pride has budded. Violence has risen up into a rod of wickedness. None of them shall remain, none of their multitude, none of them, nor shall there be wailing for them. The time has come, the day draws near. Let not the buyer rejoice, nor the seller mourn, for wrath is on their whole multitude. For the seller shall not return to what has been sold, though he may still be alive. For the vision concerns the whole multitude, and it shall not turn back. No one will strengthen himself who lives in iniquity. I guess I'll quit at verse 14. They have blown the trumpet and made everyone ready, but no one goes to battle, for my wrath is on all their multitude. I have to wonder where he talks up, the rod has blossomed, the pride has budded, violence has risen up into a rod of wickedness. What does that remind you of when you read that? Does it remind you of anything in the Old Testament?
Yeah, when there's the rebellion of Korah, was it? If I remember right?
Yeah, it's either Korah or it's closely associated with that. I don't have the verses right
here. Where he question Moses' authority and Moses was told to take his rod and I can't remember. Every leader was supposed to bring a rod or something, and Moses' rod is the one that budded.
Aaron's rod.
Yeah,
so the question was, these people were questioning the authority of Moses and Aaron.
Yeah.
And so God said, okay, bring a rod from each leader, mm-hmm. and leave it overnight in the tabernacle.
Yeah.
And I'll make clear which one's my selection. Mm-hmm. And the next morning, Aaron's rod had budded. So there's a a sense there when I read this, and I'm not sure it's intentional or not, but part of the problem there was a sin of pride. These other people said, well, they're no better than us.
Mm-hmm.
And so, in a sense, their pride was budding, but their stick wasn't, mm-hmm. right? If you want to look at it that way. Whereas Moses and Aaron, especially it says of Moses, he was like the most humble of men.
Mm-hmm.
His pride wasn't budding, he and Aaron, but God made their mm-hmm. staff bud. So it's just an interesting.
Well, it's amazing because it's not under whether you're worthy enough, it's whether that's who he chose.
Mm-hmm.
So you just have to accept the fact that that's the one he wanted.
Mm-hmm.
End of conversation. So
it's kind of funny, God doesn't pick the. Well, we talked about this before. Doesn't pick who we think he should pick. He picks probably the least of the bunch. You know, usually it's like David out with his flock. You know,
his
brothers.
Yep.
So even though you know God told those guys to bring rods, there's a sense in which their rods were rods of wickedness
mm-hmm.
because they were attempting to stand equal to Aaron's rod. If
mm-hmm.
you want to look at it that way.
And actually, I think wasn't Korah and all of his family and everything was swallowed up by the earth or something in there.
Mm-hmm.
It was they were all dealt with because
mm-hmm.
of that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So
none of them shall remain.
Mm-hmm.
Thing.
Right. So there's a very it seems like there's a reference. That God's making through Ezekiel back to that rebellion. Maybe. It's hard to say for sure. And notice, nor shall there be wailing for them. So this whole idea, too, I mean, I think there's this idea that they're not going to have a proper burial or ritual,
mm-hmm.
you know. Because a lot of the time it makes a big deal about God leaving the bodies for the animals to feed on, right?
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, we look at that and go, well, that's really ugly and rough, and it is. But I think one of the emphasis there is that they're going to die in a very unclean way.
Mm-hmm.
They're not going to be buried. They're going to be defiled by not being buried. And also, you know, many of the predatory birds were considered unclean.
Right.
It's kind of, this is one of those passages where it's like, what can you say?
Yeah.
You know? It's so direct.
Well, it also, because he's done it in a few other places too, where he tells him, don't even weep for him. And that gives you an idea of how detestable it is to him. And it's, you know, I mean, you're doing wrong if you even weep for them.
Mm-hmm.
And that's pretty darn strong, especially when it's your own kin and you're going, I just have to walk away from them like they're nothing.
Mm-hmm.
There's so much, in a sense, there's so much dirt under your feet and walk away from them.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and again, you think of, just like what you're talking about, of Aaron with his two sons
mm-hmm.
consumed, right? Yeah. He's not allowed to grieve. Because in a sense, he'd be siding with them.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Well, you want to go further?
Mm-hmm.
Anyone want to read like 15 through 22?
I can do that if you want.
Sure.
The sword is outside and the pestilence and famine within. Whoever is in the field will die by the sword, and whoever is in the city, and whoever is in the city, famine and pestilence will devour it. Those who survive will escape and be on the mountains, like doves of the valley, all of them mourning, each for his iniquity. Every hand will be feeble, and every knee will be as weak as water. They will also be girded with sackcloth. Horror will cover them, shame will be on every face, and baldness on all their heads. They will throw their silver into the streets, and their gold will be like refuge, for silver and the gold will not be able to deliver them in the day of the wrath of the Lord. They will not satisfy their souls nor fill their stomachs, because it became their stumbling block of iniquity. As for the beauty of his ornaments, he set it in majesty. As for the beauty of his ornaments, he set it in majesty, but they made it the images of their abominations, their detestable things. Therefore I have made it like refuge to them. I will give it as plunder into the hands of strangers, and to the wicked of the earth as spoil, and they shall defile it. I will turn my face from them, and they will defile my secret place, for robbers shall enter it and defile it.
Thanks, Jerry.
So the ornaments, is he talking about what we talked about before, the utensils of the sanctuary?
Yeah, I think it's related to that. I've wondered that myself and looked at it, and he's clearly making a connection, saying that there are these riches, right? Part of it is riches, and they would be, you know, gold and expensive jewels and things, and they made from it, they misused it for some of their abominations, some of their idols. And so he's saying, well, these riches that you've used for idols, even if you try to use them economically to buy things, there's going to be no food available, so you're still going to starve. So it seems like he's saying these riches that are supposed to be used for some of the holy things for me,
yeah,
you've misused them for your idols, and you're not even going to be able to leverage them economically.
Yeah, so I will give it as plunder to strangers.
So it's valuable stuff, yeah. And as far as the secret place, I think, you know, that definitely has got to be talking about the Holy of Holies. He's saying people will enter it. Robbers will enter it and defile it. And verse 22 there is the real key. I will turn my face from them. So, he's saying, I'm not going to step in. Doesn't really matter what you say, how you pray. So he's always a God that responds to repentance, but he evidently knew at this point that any repentance that they intimated was not really real repentance. It was just for show or just temporary, you know, because they were like people who are, they're not sad that they committed a crime, they're just sad they got caught.
Sure. Well, take the pressure off.
Yeah.
Of course, he will still have the remnant in there that he doesn't do this.
Right.
You see the pressure they're under when their hands will become weak and their knees, to me, that's say they're starving to death. That's just exactly what's going to happen, because all these other things are leading up to it. They're not eating, so they're just basically starving to death. And so they're going to go, okay, God, we repent.
Right.
Just to get out of the torture that they're going through.
Yeah, and so verse 18, they'll be girded with sackcloth.
Mm-hmm.
Too little, too late.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
And so he's going to turn his face, say, yeah, you're in sackcloth, but too little, too late kind of idea. A baldness on their head, same sort of thing, where they would cut their hair as a self-effacing way of grieving and so on.
Sometimes whoever takes them captive does things like that too, just to lower their esteem. Even cut off noses or ears.
Yeah, yeah, or cut off the hairs of the women. And,
the Syrians were especially bad. Yeah.
And so there's some of these passages are very similar to passages elsewhere that are prophetic, that are talking about the day of the Lord, the future day of the Lord, where God will come against pride on the earth.
Mm-hmm.
because he talks about silver and gold won't be able to develop it. You know, the same sort of issues come through there too. This is like on a smaller scale. So, oh, I'm sorry.
No, I was actually reading 23. Oh. Go ahead. I'm sorry.
Oh, well, in 21, this business of giving their riches into the hands of strangers, I don't have the exact verse here, but that's the same sort of thing comes out of the curses, you know, that the blessings and the curses part of it is that, you know, you will work to amass wealth and plenty, and it'll just go through your fingers. You know, it'll be taken away. Your houses will be given to another. Your sons and daughters will be slaves. And the things that you work for and you produce, you won't get to enjoy.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's that same idea, you know. You know, and the whole issue of you know, and strangers, he's emphasizing this issue that, you know, you're mine. You're my people. I'm intimate with you. Israel was not a stranger to God.
Mm-hmm.
Unique among the nations, they had a knowledge of God. And so when he says, you know, I'm going to give it into the hands of strangers, he's saying, you know, those people mm-hmm. that you detest that don't have a relationship with me, those are the ones I'm going to give your stuff to.
Mm-hmm. You know, the other thing I see is it's got to amaze the people around them. The Gentile nations, and because these guys have all know what's going on there, and you see how God is bringing them down, and it has to go, whoa, you know, and back a lot of people away, in a sense, going, wow, what, you know, what happened?
Mm-hmm. In the nation of Edom, you remember Esau, right? Abraham, Isaac, Jacob, and Esau, right? So Esau is the father of Edom, and there's a bunch of passages where we find out when this happens, that the Edomites celebrated the overthrow of Jerusalem. So there's one of those situations, and God is very upset about that.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
So there's a situation where even if God is disciplining Israel, don't get excited about it and say, wow, great, God, smash them.
Yeah.
mm-hmm.
You know, and I think there's a, you know, there's a lot of messages there too, because I'm not saying that you look the other way at everything Israel does, but clearly in this passage, Israel is doing all sorts of things wrong.
Mm-hmm.
God is complete. Look at the verbiage of God through this whole passage, but we can't take that verbiage up.
Mm-hmm.
God can use it,
yeah,
but we can't take that up, because there's still this business, I'll bless those who bless and I'll curse those who curse.
Mm-hmm.
And you can follow that along. And I think, personally, I think it still holds that people who understand the Bible, they won't condone Israel and what she does in every case, but they'll recognize that, you know, let God discipline,
mm-hmm.
keep our hands away,
yeah.
right?
Well, don't rejoice in when
somebody has a problem. There's some place in the Bible where it says that God, you know, God brought all these nations, Assyria and Babylon, against Jerusalem. This was God brought them.
Yeah, yeah.
And then later on, he punished them because they enjoyed it too much.
Yeah.
You know, they went too far. You know, so
yeah.
Well, that was interesting.
One of the issues too, though, is in a sense, God's name is being smeared to the joining nations, because
mm-hmm.
they know it's his people and look what's happening to them. So
mm-hmm.
it talks about, you know, that's an element of the, and I can't know the specifics, but he talks about he wants his name to remain, you know, it's
right.
Part of the part of it.
I was listening again to something, I think it was Andy Wood, where he talked about why you think they got Egyptians were drowned, because they were drowning the kids, and time later they got drowned, and then they got killed the firstborn, and they're the firstborn. Well,
yeah.
They killed the Israel is his firstborn, and then then God killed their firstborn. So
yeah, there's a lot of hard lessons.
Yeah.